This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Dale. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Consumer product recalls hit record levels in 2007, and just over half of the items recalled were products for children. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be taking a look at what the government is doing to try to keep dangerous products off the market. And the guest for the program this morning is Joel Tickner. He is assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, where he is also a principal investigator at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. His training is in toxics, chemicals policy and epidemiology, and risk assessment and pollution prevention. He served as advisor and researcher for several governmental agencies, for nonprofit environmental groups and trade unions, both in the United States and abroad, during the past 10 years. If you're interested, by the way, in this subject, you might want to take a look at the website of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. And we'll be talking about a couple of reports that you can read there that they have put out. One is The Presumption of Safety, Limits of Federal Policies on Toxic Substances in Consumer Products, and the other, Options for State Chemicals Policy Reform, a resource guide. You can go to the website. It's www.sustainableproduction.org, and you can look at that and a lot of other information on this subject. And, of course, here as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call. We just ask people to try to keep their comments brief so we can keep our program moving along. But of course, anyone's welcome to call. Professor Tickner, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on air.
We certainly do. It seems like we have a problem, at least with the kind of news that we have had over the past year or so, increasing concerns about products that are tainted or problematic, a wide range of things. Toys for children has been a concern. Other kinds of products now. There, recently we've had a concern about possible contamination of pharmaceuticals. There have been concerns about other over-the-counter products like health and beauty aids. Is the problem now become more serious than it has been in the past?
I think it's the problem we've been living with for the past 30 years. We're just starting to recognize it now and take it a little bit more seriously than we have over the last 40 years.
So why should that be, that it's something that has been a feature of our lives but it hasn't gotten that much attention until relatively recently?
Well, I think the science has evolved. So 30 years ago, our concerns about contaminants in the environment were very high-level concerns. There were rivers catching on fire. There were big exposures in the workplace. There were hazardous waste dumps. And these were large exposures coming from manufacturing plants. And as we learn more about many substances, we're learning that lower and lower exposures, particularly at vulnerable times in development, like in the fetal stage or in childhood, can lead to long-lasting effects. So we're beginning to be much more concerned about chemicals in everyday products and not just the pollution coming from factories.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and start talking about some of the basic points that you make, particularly in the presumption of safety report. And I think just to start out, I expect that on the part of people's on the part of American people, there is this expectation that there is someone somewhere in the government, some agency that is looking out for them and that is doing product testing, perhaps, or at least keeping track of new products that come out to determine whether, in fact, they are safe. And in fact, that's not really the case. It seems that one of the problems here is that we are relying on the producers of the products to do that work.
Exactly. There is this idea, and this comes from surveys around the country, that people believe that if they can go to the supermarket and buy a cleaning chemical, for example, that someone has tested that chemical and someone has ensured that it's safe. And And in focus groups we've done, when we indicate to the people that that's not the case, they're extremely surprised. People put a lot of trust in government to ensure that chemicals are safe. They think about industrial chemicals like they think about drugs, which we know are heavily regulated in the United States, and they apply that kind of rationale to consumer products. And what we did in these reports is we've focused a lot on the EPA side, the Environmental Protection Agency side of regulating chemicals and commerce, and no one has really paid attention to the Consumer Product Safety Commission and its laws and how they regulate chemicals and consumer products. And what we found is that it is a very problematic situation where, essentially, as long as we don't know anything about a chemical in a product, we consider it safe. As long as we can't prove it's dangerous, we consider it safe and okay to use.
You know, it seems that we recently here on the program have had some conversations dealing with things like how drugs are developed and tested. Just recently, to a program to address some of the concerns that people have about food safety, which also I think some of that extends to things like various kinds of over-the-counter products and medications. And it seems that there is one flaw that's common to all of these systems, and that is we put the onus on the producers to determine that things are safe and effective. And the problem there is that it's in their vested interest to show that they are indeed safe and effective. And what you would like to have is someone doing product testing that has no vested interest in the outcome, someone who is truly an independent. And that just doesn't seem to be the case. And not only is it not the case with stuff you clean your floor with, it's not the case with prescription drugs. It seems like it's not really the case with anything.
Well, it's starting to be more and more the case with certain consumer products. Governments are increasingly requiring green products in their procurement specifications, and there are labeling and certification schemes like Green Seal or the Environmental Protection Agency's Design for Environment program, where companies actually have to have their products certified that they don't contain certain things or that they have tested them in certain ways. There's more of that, but for the most part, the vast majority of toxic substances in commerce today were assumed safe until proven dangerous, and the burden then is on a government agency like the EPA to demonstrate they're dangerous, and the default is no problem. So you're right that putting all the burden on the manufacturers, they have the responsibility of showing safety. They should have the responsibility, but there needs to be a shared burden between the government and industry to make sure that we're looking for the right things and that we actually have identified what's a problem.
Yeah. It also seems to be the case with this, as in regulation of some other products, that it may be a little unclear sometimes what government agency is responsible. For example, we talked last week about the problem with food and the two main bodies that regulate food, the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, and the Food and Drug Administration. It's sometimes a little difficult to understand who's responsible for what, but then there are also a number of other governmental entities that are responsible for different sorts of things. And one problem there seems to be is that there's no one person who's really in charge. Here in this particular case, we have at least two governmental entities, that is the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission, that have some responsibilities here. Is this another case where sometimes its lines of authority are unclear, or it's difficult to determine, say, for a particular product, who is responsible for determining that that product is safe or that there is a problem?
There is a big problem with jurisdiction here, and let me give you one case in point, which was lead in children's lunchboxes. And I was on an EPA committee where we were looking at a general recommendation that lead not be in children's products, and we asked the question of who's in charge of the lunchbox, and it turns out the FDA is in charge of the inside of the lunchbox, the CPSC is in charge of the outside of the lunchbox. So we do need to centralize. Lead is lead. No matter what product it's in, it is a hazard to children. So we need to start thinking about how we manage chemicals in society based on their intrinsic hazards and not how they're used, so we can address the problem that lead shouldn't be in products, most products, period.
Mm-hmm. There does seem to be a problem in a number of these agencies, again, that are responsible for doing various kinds of oversight, that they simply don't have the resources to do the job. And certainly the job that we've given to the Consumer Product Safety Commission is a big one. It has had cuts in its budget and staff over the past few years. Do you think that the Consumer Product Safety Commission has the resources to do the job that we expect?
Absolutely not. Their budget has been cut in about half since the 1980s. They have only about four toxicologists on staff to look at the thousands of chemicals in thousands of products. They get no information on the chemical constituents of products. It's virtually an impossible task. But I'm not sure that just strengthening their budget will solve the problem, because they and EPA operate as heroically under a set of guidelines or regulations that basically tie their hands. So, for example, for the CPSC to prohibit a chemical in a consumer product, the burdens on them are so high that it is almost impossible for them to restrict a chemical. One of those burdens is, for example, the EPA has to demonstrate that the benefits of protecting a child's health, which may be in far into the future, exceed the cost industry of making changes in a product, which are immediate.
Hmm. Let me just then ask a very basic question. Supposing that you have a toy that you want to sell in the United States, and let us suppose that it's been manufactured outside of the United States, so you want to import that to the country and put it on the shelves of department stores. What do you have to do, or do you have to do anything? If I was the importer and I was going to stamp my name on that product, what do I have to do to demonstrate that it's safe?
Very little. There are CPSC specifications that come out of law of materials that cannot be in the toys. CPSC has focused much of their attention on safety risks, electrical, fire, choking. Those are fairly well established. So a lot of the guidelines are about how the rim top of a bottle, so that someone can't swallow it, or the size of a marble, not the chemical constituents, which are much less known. So you would go, for example, there's a standard, the ASTM standard, that has all of the specifications for toys. You would look at that, make sure that your testing complies with all those specifications, and as long as you comply with that, you're fine to go.
Hmm.
In essence, as long as it's not prohibited, it's okay.
Yeah. And then is it likely that anybody the commission or anybody else is going to take a close look at that product unless there already has been some problem reported with it?
That is the case. They're so struggling to even enforce their own regulations that looking for a problem that is on the horizon is very hard, unless it's a very obvious problem, like when the date rape drug was in these aqua beads.
You tell that story. That's it still sort of floors me.
Basically, what happened, and this is a story out of Australia, that there was a cheaper version of a material used for making these aqua beads, which when it entered the body, it metabolized into the date rape drug. And it was a doctor who was also a biochemist, a physician in Australia, who realized that and was able to trace it back to a lower quality material being used in China.
And this is not something that was intended for internal consumption, right?
Absolutely not. But you have to assume kids are going to chew on things and suck on things. Even the most innocuous products, like telephone wires, anyone with kids knows kids put everything in their mouth.
Hmm. Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who's just joined us. We're talking with Dr. Joel Tickner. He is assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability at University of Massachusetts Lowell, where he is also a principal investigator at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. His training is in toxics, chemicals policy, and epidemiology, risk assessment, and pollution prevention. And we're talking some about the outfit there at Lowell, and particularly some of their recommendations on dealing with toxic substances in consumer products. They put out a report on this subject, and as I mentioned at the beginning, they have a website. So if you go there, you can take a look at this and other information on this sort of subject. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Urbana, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm curious about whether there's, you see these ads for like Lysol and basically disinfecting products where the mama's following the kids around, like spraying every surface and all in this cloud of, you know, aerosolized who knows what. So I'm wondering if you know anything about the kind of effect something like this has on children.
That's a great question, and not an easy one to answer. It all depends on the product itself and its chemical constituents. So there is good scientific evidence that many cleaning products contain asthmogens in them that could increase the risk of asthma in a child. Some of them contain chemicals that may be toxic to the neurological system. It all depends on the product. Again, one of the questions is, do you really need a totally sanitized house, or is simple cleaning enough to avoid the use of the chemicals in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Is there any place that consumers can go as some sort of good central data bank so that if they have concerns about a particular product, they can put the name of that product in there and see what comes up?
Yes, the National Library of Medicine has a consumer products database. If you just Google it, the website I don't have here offhand, but they have a very good database where you can put in a product name or a chemical name. It'll search on which products it is, and then it'll link to the material safety data sheet and other toxicity information.
Okay, and that's so I'm assuming that if people just go to their, if they have internet access, they can pull up their browser and just put in National Library of Medicine.
Consumer Products Database, yeah.
Consumer Products Database, and they should be able to get that. Good,
yep.
Very good.
It's a good source of information.
Okay, and other questions are welcome here too, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Does the Consumer Product Safety Commissioner, what sort of authority do they have to issue mandatory recall?
Their mandatory recall authorities are very limited because they have to go through this regulatory process. So most recalls are voluntary in nature because it's just much more expeditious to do it. Right now, because they don't even have a quorum, to issue a recall, they need a quorum on the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is three commissioners. They don't have three right now, so they actually cannot even do a mandatory recall at this point.
So how long has that been the case?
For several years. They're supposed to have five commissioners. There's only three and two standing right now.
Mm. Just last week, the Senate passed a proposal that would strengthen the Consumer Product Safety Commission, would increase its staff, would increase its budget. There also had been something similar, but I believe not quite as strong, passed by the House. So now that the House and the Senate are going to have to get together on this. And so one doesn't know what is going to come out of this. The White House was pretty much down on the Senate version and seemed to be supporting the House version. Do you think that something or what do you think is going to come of this? And do you, in fact, think that this is going to help?
They'll help around the edges. What I see these bills is tweaking the edges rather than thinking about the fundamental problems. As long as there's very little data on the chemical constituents of products, as long as the burden is so high on the CPSC to take action, it's going to be difficult for them to do anything. So they may be able to act on lead better. They may be able to act on certain chemicals called phthalates, which are in the bill, better. But they're not going to address the fundamental flaws in the system, which is that potentially harmful chemicals can make it into consumer products without any oversight.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, for example, I forgive me for continuing to go back to other programs, but a couple of weeks ago I was talking with someone about the particular problem of pharmaceuticals and testing products. And he said he really believed that what should happen is that the government should set up or the government actually should fund the testing. I think he was suggesting that perhaps you could set up centers at colleges and universities who would do the testing, and they would have to declare that they had no interest or could have no interest in the products, so that their opinion should be completely objective. But essentially what he said was for developing pharmaceuticals, for testing, for safety, efficacy should be taken out of the hands of the people who have the financial interest in the outcome. Do you see that it as being possible that and I suppose it all does come down to money. It's just a matter of money that we could have some kind of government entity set up or government-funded entity set up to test new products as they come along or to test existing products?
I think it would be a very big task. You're talking about thousands of chemicals and consumer products. And I'm not sure that testing every product is the right way to proceed, but really making sure that those products don't have chemical constituents of concern. So I think the first thing we need to do is get some basic data on the majority of chemicals out there in commerce, prioritize those chemicals into chemicals of higher concern and chemicals of lower concern so that we can address the chemicals of higher concern quickly, get them out of products, and transition into safer chemicals. And I think the third part then is putting resources into the research and development of the safer chemistries. So as long as we're focusing on a product-by-product basis, we're really not going to get to the fundamental transition towards safer chemistry.
Mm. Well, if you could come up with a – I'm not asking you to do it, but if one could come up with a rough list of these chemicals of concern, would you be talking about, what, 20, 50, 100, more?
We're talking thousands.
Thousands.
The European Union has just passed a fundamental reform of their chemicals regulation called Registration, Evaluation, and Authorization of Chemicals. And under REACH, that's the acronym, chemicals of higher concern, so those that stick around in the environment, that build up in our bodies, that may cause cancer or reproductive harm, those chemicals are going to be treated like drugs where industry will have to ask for permission to continue using them. Under REACH, there's probably about 1,500 chemicals that will fit that definition of substances of very high concern. So I think we're talking a couple thousand.
Hmm. We have several other callers. We'll just get right back to them and talk next with someone in Champaign, and this would be line one. Hello.
Hi. I was calling about a chemical, BPA, which is used in food containers and that we eat out of and food is stored up and people put in the microwave and this type of thing. And I was wondering if you think there will be any legislation to get BPA removed from food products.
It's a great question. It's something I'm very familiar with. There are about six states right now that have legislation pending that's being discussed right now about restricting BPA in consumer products. It makes sense. If there are safer alternatives, we should not be exposing consumers to potentially dangerous chemicals. There is controversy in the science about BPA, but I think it comes down to, is there a safer way to be doing it? And in many cases, yes. I don't think it makes sense to be exposing children to BPA if they don't need to be exposed to it at this point.
Just maybe you'd better can tell us what it is that we're talking about here?
Bisphenol A is a building block of polycarbonate plastics. That would be your Nalgene bottle, some windshield materials, CDs. Bisphenol A is also a primary material used in lots of resins, so can linings, tin can linings is the main use. Baby bottles also contain polycarbonate plastic, and bisphenol A can leach out when the material in the baby bottle is heated, so milk.
Uh-huh. So this is the concern, and I know that in some of our programming we've had some focus on this recently. This is where the concern comes of perhaps plastic water bottles maybe, but also plastic containers that people might heat food in the microwave, or perhaps also, as you say, there some, not all, some canned goods do have these plastic liners. And in the processing of the food, obviously what they've got to do is it's got to be heated. And so there is some of those concerns. And I suppose also there are some things that people can do if they'd like to minimize their exposure, and that is, to the extent that they can, not use these products. And I suppose it is certainly easy enough not to heat stuff in plastic in your own home.
Right. I mean, for example, glass baby bottles, there's a huge increase in market for glass baby bottles as compared to the plastic ones. So, yes, there are certain things consumers can be doing, but, you know, certain uses of BPA may be perfectly acceptable. For example, windshields, where polycarbonate is a very versatile material, and it may make sense to use it in some uses while we're seeking alternatives or trying to minimize any kind of leaching that may take place from the plastic.
All right. Let's continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Lovington, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I heard yesterday, the day before, that there is concern about actually medicines going through the body into municipal water and the treatment doesn't necessarily take those out. Is that a concern that you are involved with?
I'm not currently involved in it. I've started to look at it, and I find it a very concerning issue. That what happens is many drugs, when we take them, they're not fully metabolized. So when we go to the bathroom, we basically are excreting them into waterways, and many of those contaminants are not fully broken down by wastewater treatment or removed by disinfection in water quality. It is receiving inadequate attention from our federal government. In the EPA, there's essentially one person working on this who runs the lab for EPA in Las Vegas, and he's been sort of shuttered out on the issue. I know the pharmaceutical industry is starting to take this very seriously, looking at how their drugs break down at the end of life, but for the most part, for the past 30 years, 40 years, this has not been looked at, and it really needs to be seriously looked at, because in the end, when we talk about a mixture like pharmaceuticals and other products in the environment, there's absolutely no way to assess the risk of it. We have a hard enough time understanding what the human health risks are of single chemical exposures, let alone a complex mixture.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's continue. And then our next person here is in Champaign and line number 3. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to give you all a piece of information. I just did a program at Parkland on what it means to go green and shared a website with people who attended. It's www.ecolabeling.org. It's a wonderful resource to look at any eco-label. They have 274 listed, and they can tell an individual whether the item that they're considering is approved by an independent agency, or whether this is a pat on the back that the company has actually given itself. So it's a good protection resource to take a look at different labels that are out there that are supposed to be approving the products. That's all. Just wanted to share that.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great resource, and I'm not sure they approve them. They certify them. Government approves them, but they're certified, and it really is important for consumers to understand that something that just says it's green doesn't necessarily mean it's green.
I'm sure that there is growing, and there will continue to be growing concern about this, and people are going to want in their consumer choices, going to want to make good choices, things that they think are good choices for themselves and their family and their health and also for the environment. Is this something that you think that that there will be, consumer interest, do you think that will put increasing pressure or put some kind of pressure on both industry and also government to try to address these issues?
Most definitely. Look at, for example, what Walmart is doing. Walmart is really trying to reinvent itself as a green products company, and they're putting a lot of pressure on their supply chains to meet some minimal environmental standards for different types of products. We're going to see a lot more pressure from consumers, and I think about consumers broadly. Consumers aren't just the people going to the store and buying things, but they're big consumers of products. So Home Depot has just started an eco-labeling campaign. So a lot of big purchasers are going that way, and a lot of the forward-looking firms are going in this direction. They really do want their products, which they believe are adequately tested, are greener than their competitors, to be preferentially treated in the marketplace. They may be slightly more expensive, but having preferential treatment may get them the market advantage they need.
Let me quickly introduce again our guest, and we'll go on to take some other callers. We're talking this morning with Joel Tickner. He's assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, where he's also a principal investigator at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. This is a place where they're interested in applying science and research to promote communities, workplaces, and products that are healthy, humane, and respectful of natural systems. And here I'm reading off of what you can find about them on their website. And if you're interested, the center does indeed have a website, and you can go there and you can look at a variety of kind of information on this subject. So that's something that you might want to do as well. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have some other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Ford County on our line 4. Hello.
Hi, David. Another great show. You are a servant of the community. Doctor, could you please explain again this lack of the quorum? Because I think this is at the heart of what's wrong here is lack of enforcement.
Well, my understanding, and I can't say I'm an expert on the Consumer Product Safety Commission, but there are 5 elected officials who serve as basically the political leadership of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So they can be, you know, depending on who's president and when their terms run out, 5. Right now there's only 3. They need a quorum of 3. And if one of them abstains from voting, which is what's been happening, or isn't available, they only have 2. If they don't have a quorum, they can't vote on a regulation or any kind of policy coming out of the agency. It's very politicized agency. It's not a lot of times the science gets overruled by politics, which is what's happening these days.
Is there any way that we as consumers can affect that in a positive way? And if you will allow me, I'll tell you a short story about what happens to me. I get neurologically affected by things like fabric softener that happen to be in large stores like Walmart and such, and just people walking by with perfume. And I started out with EPA air quality because it affects my breathing space. They said, well, you know, we can't deal with that. Why don't you go to Consumer Product Safety Commission? So I went to Consumer Product Safety Commission, and they said, well, you know, those are scents, and scents are regulated by the FDA. So I went to the FDA, and the FDA says, well, you know, scents are proprietary chemical formulas, and we don't regulate those, so you would have to go to the companies. And, of course, the companies hold that as a trade secret, and the companies are actually allowed to write their own rules into the law regarding the regulation of scents. And so the FDA said, if you have a complaint, go to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So I got caught in this revolving door.
Right. It's you've just hit on the nose. One of the biggest problems is there's no one minding the house.
And thank you.
What we need here is to really fundamentally reform the way we manage chemicals in society and have a single agency that's in charge of all of this. It turns out that there is a division of EPA that's starting to look at fragrances in consumer cleaning products because they do see that fragrances are an area of concern for sensitization. This is the Design for Environment program of EPA, which is focused on stimulating the design and implementation or application of safer products.
How would you respond to the, I think, the administration, perhaps some members of Congress who would say something like, you know, tougher regulations in these areas, really, it's going to be a burden on the product manufacturers? And no doubt then the product manufacturers would say something like, well, you know, if you put pressure on us either to do more testing of the products that we use or the chemical constituents, or if you make it our responsibility to demonstrate product safety, that ultimately we're just going to have to charge more for the product and the consumer is going to end up paying more.
Well, I think there's several issues here. One, there's very little evidence that environmental regulation actually affects the bottom line. In fact, Michael Porter, who's a business professor at Harvard, has shown quite well that regulation actually leads to innovation, which reduces cost in the long run. And yes, greener products may, in some cases, be slightly more expensive, and that's in part because we've incentivized the more harmful products. For example, if I can continue to use Chemical X in my product because it has no regulation, and Chemical Y has to go through some level of testing, which new chemicals on the market do, then it's cheaper to continue the old way of doing things. So there may be some transitions here that have to happen, but what we're finding with the companies we work with is they're being enormously successful with safer chemicals. They can make a price premium. They can expand their markets, and there are lots of companies that are quickly growing where they're making safer products. One example of a company we've been working with is Method, which sells at Target stores. And this is a company that started from basically nothing to a huge increase in growth, selling safer, environmentally friendly, and consumer exciting products.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other folks. Let's go to line two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I am wondering if you could talk a little bit about the safety of vaccines, and as you're for children, and as you were talking about the whole process of assuring consumer safety, that's one of my concerns. I have two little children who've all been, gone through all their vaccinations, and yet when I ask the question, I'm kind of looked at as one of those wacky people that, has some conspiracy theory or something, when I just don't want to put stuff into my those little bodies if it's going to hurt them. And I'm constantly told they're absolutely safe. There's no link between anything bad. And anyway, there's my question. Thanks.
Okay.
You have a great question, and I'm not an expert in the subject. Certainly, I follow it. I come from the public health community, which is very pro-vaccination. We know that vaccination has extreme benefits in society. There are certainly cases where I think we could make a reasonable public health argument that we shouldn't be doing. Mercury is a preservative in vaccines. That's an economic issue, and it makes absolutely no sense to inject mercury into kids' bodies because we don't know what it can do to children, and we know enough about what mercury's effects are in other aspects, in other products, and in the environment, that it doesn't make a lot of sense if there are alternatives. So it's a very controversial area. There are strong opinions on both sides, and I think it's going to take time to play itself out.
Mm-hmm. I know with the mercury issue, I think I remember being told even just a couple years ago that, having this 100% reassurance that it's okay. And then you just recently, you hear about them. Okay, no, there's no more mercury. And it just makes me think, well, you were so sure a couple years ago. So anyway, I'm not an anti-vaccine person either. I definitely know the benefits of that. So
believe me, it hits home. I have two small children. They're 6 and 8, and I've gone through the same challenging questions of what do I do as a parent. And, there's certain things I did. I pushed back vaccine timing to, make sure, the first year of life, brain's doing a lot of its most biggest development. Well, I pushed back vaccines as long as I could. And then certain ones, you can do an antibody teeter on those. And if you have the antibodies, you don't need the vaccine.
Hmm.
So I believe MMR is one of them.
Thank you for that information. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call. And just because this is really a subject for another show, because it certainly could be another show, but because people are so concerned about this, and there has been this concern about the use of mercury as a preservative in vaccines, and the potential, some people feel that there might, I want to draw a big line into that, might have been some relation between that and autism.
Right.
I think we should make sure people know, first of all, that the mercury was, it is my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the mercury was taken out of these vaccines about 7 years ago.
Yes.
And that in the years since, not only has there been not a decline in autism, there has been an increase in autism. So you would think that if there was any relationship between the mercury and the autism, you would have seen the opposite effect. So if you're worried about mercury today, well, that's not in the vaccine anymore. And if you're worried about autism and vaccines, there doesn't seem to be as yet much good evidence to suggest that there is any relationship.
Exactly. It's a controversial. I mean, there's science on both sides, and as someone who looks at industrial chemicals, I can only make my own informed decision, but I don't feel like I'm a competent person to say there is a problem or there's not a problem.
Yeah, it's as I say, probably that's something we should think about doing a program on and finding some more guests, and that's worth spending an entire 50 minutes on.
Yeah, oh, definitely, and it's a separate issue than industrial chemicals in consumer products, where they're really, I mean, you can argue vaccines have a very important public health benefit. When you're dealing with any particular chemical in a consumer product, for the most part, they don't have a particular need or benefit.
Yeah. Well, again, we're moving into about our last 10 minutes or so. We are talking indeed about chemicals in consumer products and how they're regulated and who's testing them and so forth. And I do, again, want to introduce our guest, Joel Tickner. He's assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, where he's also principal investigator at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's go next to Rockford, line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Professor. Your story about baby bottles just got me. I reuse plastic water bottles, and I freeze about one-third, and I fill the rest with water or pop. Is this okay, or are any chemicals leaching into my drinks?
Well, it's another good question. There has been some examination. It's a different plastic than the baby bottle plastic, polycarbonate's a hard, brittle plastic. Most water bottles are PET, P-E-T plastic. There are some concerns about some chemicals that may leach out of PET. They're still back and forth about, you know, how many times you should reuse a water bottle. I'm sitting here in front of myself with a reused water bottle right now. So a lot of this is putting it into perspective as well. I'm older, so I don't worry about as much these issues as with my kids, where their exposure could be a lifelong effect.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm older myself, 57. But, all right, would I do the same thing on frozen food containers? I split up things, put them in the former plastic containers, and then freeze them. And sometimes I'll put them in Corningware, but every now and then, if I'm in a hurry, I'll put them in a microwave. Is that the same idea, the chemicals leaching? Or?
Well, you think about, I mean, anyone who's microwave plastics is over-microwaved at times, and you see the shrinking. Well, if that stuff is shrinking, there's probably some petrochemicals leaching out of that. So if you want to minimize the leaching, it's probably a good idea to not reheat in the plastic and to use a Corningware or something, a glass to reheat in.
Okay, perfect. Look, I appreciate your assistance.
Okay, thanks
for
the call.
One.
Let's go on here. Next is someone in Champaign. This is line 1. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to comment on the fact that the federal government doesn't seem to be doing a good job of regulating these chemicals. And so what recourse do consumers have against companies that are putting these chemicals into our products?
Well, I think that's a great question. And a lot of what's happening in the absence of any federal leadership, consumer groups at the national and the state level are taking action into their own hands. So if you look, for example, at chemicals in cosmetics, the European Union restricted chemicals that can cause cancer or reproductive harm in cosmetics. The U.S. cosmetic companies that operate in Europe have to comply with that. They weren't necessarily going to comply with that regulation here in the United States, where we have absolutely no regulation on chemical constituents of cosmetics. So a group of citizens group, breast cancer activists, environmental groups, environmental health groups, public health groups, formed a coalition for safe cosmetics, and they forced, through market pressure, the cosmetics companies to sign on to an agreement that they would obey by the European standards here in the United States. So there is a real need to for consumers, organized consumers, to put pressure on the manufacturers, but also at the state level. We're seeing a lot of leadership in the various states, including Illinois. The Illinois legislature is looking at several bills on chemical constituents of consumer products. For example, flame retardants in couches and consumer electronics. Several groups in Illinois are working on this, and it would make sense for consumers in their states to work with these public health coalitions to move policy at the state level.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yeah, sure, it does. So the example of the host having that allergy to perfume, so would he have any recourse against the companies that put those chemicals in the perfume?
Probably not. There's probably little. Product liability is a very hard area, because basically you have to demonstrate that your particular harm was caused by, more likely than not, by that consumer product. It's fairly hard to do. A lot of people argue that toys are safe or consumer products are safe because companies are really concerned about liability. Liability as a driver may or may not work. It'll at least get companies to think about the safety aspects of their products. It doesn't necessarily get them to change them.
Okay, sounds great.
All right. Well, just to underscore the point, Professor Tickner, that you made, it's very clear, the report that your center issued, that you think that the regulations that exist now are not adequate to protect people from the potential hazard of chemicals and products that they use every day. You think that it may be, in fact, the possibility for changing things might be a little bit stronger with state governments than it is with federal government.
I think at this point, yes. And this is the way it's typically been in the United States, that federal government inaction leads to the states to act. California, for example, in air regulations. There are now about 7 or 8 states, Washington, Maine, Massachusetts, New York, California, Michigan, Illinois, where legislators, environmental coalitions are getting together and saying, you know, what can we be doing at the state level? Ideally, we'd be doing this at the federal level, and the hope is that in a new administration, we may do that. Our federal toxics laws, the Consumer Product Safety Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which EPA implements, are over 30 years old, and they are in bad need of repair. Our science has evolved. Our understanding of how chemicals are in products have evolved. Our knowledge about how to design safer chemicals and products has evolved, and we really need a new approach that gets basic data on the chemical constituents of products, prioritizes the ones of highest concern, and encourages or requires the substitution of problem chemicals with safer alternatives, and lastly, provides the incentives and the research and development to design the products of green chemistry, the safer products.
All right, let's get at least one more caller here, someone here in Central Illinois, where we are, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I'm on dialysis, and my concern is heparin. And I'd like to know if there's a viable substitute.
This may be getting outside of your area. I don't know.
It's definitely outside of my area. I wish I could help you with that, but
you know, they're having a problem with it.
Yeah, I think perhaps people might have read some of the reporting on this. It's been in the New York Times, it's been in the Wall Street Journal about the potential. There seems to be some sort of contaminant that's in some of the heparin that has come from China, and it has caused problems in Germany. It's caused problems in the United States. Some people have died from it, and I think they're not exactly sure what's going on with it yet. But it seems like that's a question that you're going to have to address to a physician. I think that's maybe not quite what we can do with this morning's program. I don't know. Professor Tickner, is probably nothing else that you could really say.
Right. That's beyond my area of knowledge, unfortunately.
All right. My apologies on that. Although I think that we do indeed face, with the increasing globalization of the production of food products and consumer products and pharmaceuticals and over-the-counter health and beauty aids, all of these things, I guess we shouldn't be surprised if we start to see more problems like that.
Right. I think that's right. And let me note, though, that in some ways the U.S. may be falling behind China and India, because China and India want to maintain the European market. So if you've got Europe passing very strong regulations on chemical safety and consumer products, the Chinese companies are going to have to comply, and that will be a driver. I really, in many ways, don't think the problem is cheap Chinese imports. I think it's poor U.S. regulations.
Hmm. We're coming to the point here. We just have maybe about 2 minutes left, and it seems very clear, as I've said, that you believe, and the center believes that it has said as much in this report, that we do need to change the system that we have to regulate potential hazards in consumer products. Just again, as a way of summarizing, what is it that you would like to see happen?
We would like to see a fundamental reform of the two federal laws, or two or three key federal laws regulating chemicals and products, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which EPA implements, the Consumer Product Safety Act, and the Federal Hazardous Substances Act. Ideally, we would be creating a new policy that focuses on the inherent toxicity of the chemicals, not how they're used, but really starting at how they're designed, what their hazards are, getting a good understanding of how they can potentially harm health or the environment, focusing on prioritizing those chemicals, really getting a rapid screening of all chemicals in commerce, understanding which ones are higher or lower concern, forcing the ones of highest concern to be substituted with safer alternatives, and then providing incentives for research and development to develop the safer, cleaner chemicals of the future. And I think really the whole approach of focusing chemical by chemical, product by product, like the bisphenol A, is a misguided approach. We really need fundamental reform to make it easier for governments to act so that they don't have to go years before they act. One particular example is EPA and asbestos. EPA had 10 years of research on asbestos, went to ban it in 1990 using its authorities, and that ban got overturned in the courts because they hadn't met their burden. Well, when you spend 10 years and do 10,000 pages of public record and you get turned over, you're not going to go and do it again because the burden is just too high to act. So we've got to reduce those burdens and allow government to be able to do their job to protect our health.
Well, at that, we will stop again with a suggestion that if you're interested in getting more information on this subject, you might take a look at the website of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, which is based at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. Our guest, Dr. Joel Tickner, is principal investigator at the center. He is also assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability at UMass Lowell. And Dr. Tickner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on air.
Programs here on WILL are made possible in part by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting A Springtime of Classical Music with the Orion String Quartet, Zsolt Wagner, Kronos Quartet, and Anton QWERTY. For more information, you can go to their website. It is krannertcenter.com. Tomorrow morning on the program, we welcome back Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with Extension in Champaign County, and she's with us once a month, always on Tuesday, to talk about lawn and garden care. Things sooner or later, the winter's going to be over, and things are going to start growing, and I'm sure people who are really serious gardeners are already thinking about what they're going to be doing this year. Maybe if you have some kind of problem unsolved from last year, or you're thinking about what you'd like to plant and you'd like to get some advice, you should be tuned in tomorrow, and we'll be happy to take your questions. That's tomorrow in the first hour, the 10 o'clock hour of the show. Right now, we hope that you'll stay tuned because coming up next, we have news, features, sports, weather, a lot of other things, and another interview, all as part of the Afternoon Magazine and the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the Amish of East Central Illinois. We'll have two guests with us, News Gazette journalists Rebecca Mabry and Vonda Bidwell. The reporter and photographer spent many months recording the lives of the Amish in Illinois. Together with the newspaper, they have produced the book, The Amish of Illinois' Heartland, and they'll join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. March wheat is trading at $11.42. That is down 3. In Chicago, March wheat, $10.90, down 2.5. July, $10.90, up 21.5. March corn, $5.44, up 10.5. $5.55¾ is the going price for the May corn contract. That's up 8.5. July, $5.66, up 7. December, $5.68, up 8¾. March beans, $13.81, up 40. May, $14.05½, down 3¼. July, $14.20, down 1. November, $12.97½, down 14. March meal, $3.46.70, up 7.70. March oil, $62.05, up 1.80. At the Merck in Chicago, April live cattle, $90.05, down 47.5. June, $91.75, down 25. March feeder cattle, $100.05, down 55. April, $103.05, down 92.5.